CBS and Viacom finally get back together and are still tiny by media consolidation standards. Plus, a casualty of a media merger from days gone by. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Oakland, California, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, August 13th, and it's good to have you with us. My apologies in advance, though, because we're going to give you a little more tariff whiplash. It wasn't even 2 weeks ago that President Trump threatened new tariffs, which are, it should be said here again, taxes on $300 billion worth of Chinese goods starting September 1st. Ones you would notice, like cell phones, laptops, video games. But today, the president walked back that threat, and some of those tariffs now won't kick in until mid-December. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore tells us what that's about.
Cell phones, cameras, video games, Christmas tree lights, all among the imports from China that won't be taxed until mid-December. December. What happens in December?
Holiday shopping season.
Oh, right. Richard Weiner is an international trade lawyer with Sidley Austin. He says it is no coincidence that these particular gifty kinds of goods are not going to get taxed until well after retailers have had a chance to stock up for holiday shoppers.
Santa and his elves vote in purple states, and they don't want to lose those votes, so they've backed away from this threat.
The president has often said that China pays these tariffs, but today the president himself told reporters he postponed them in case they had an impact on holiday shopping.
Their claims that China pays these tariffs simply is not true.
There's another possible reason the president delayed some of these import taxes.
I think they were delayed because the president started seeing the markets tank.
Nicole Bivens-Collinson is a trade lawyer with Sandler, Travis & Rosenberg. The S&P 500 fell 3% in the days after Trump's announcement at the beginning of August. But while he delayed tariffs on some things, they are going full steam ahead on lots of others, including everything from vanadium chloride to a lot of women's apparel.
We make wedding gowns. We make quinceañera dresses, prom dresses.
Stephen Lang owns Mon Cheri Bridal, and he's president of the American Bridal and Prom Industry Association.
What he's just done is he's raised my duty bill by 40%, which is enormous. I mean, I paid $5 million in duties last year.
He says that is bound to put some people out of business. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
And at long last, so long it barely feels like news anymore, CBS and Viacom will be one again. Media mogul Sumner Redstone split his empire in two back in 2006. But the two companies have been working toward a sometimes rocky reunion for a few years now. The deal announced today brings Paramount Pictures, Comedy Central, MTV, the CBS Broadcast Network, Showtime, and some other properties all under the ownership of one entity that will be worth about $30 billion. Also, sounds like the makings of a pretty good streaming lineup, am I right? Keech Hagee covers television for The Wall Street Journal and wrote the book about CBS and Viacom. Keech, thanks for joining me.
Glad to be here.
So we know this has been a long saga. These companies were joined once before, broken up forever. Now they're back together. But my real question is, how different is the media landscape that they're in now?
Well, it's completely different. I mean, what really changed was Netflix and the destruction of the cable bundle that really built Viacom, or the old Viacom, as this cable powerhouse. I mean, Netflix came along and that bundle started to erode, and it's really, really challenging to be a cable-based company out there. So it makes sense that they would need more scale.
But, you know, the market cap of CBS and Viacom combined is still just a fraction of some of these media giants, AT&T, Disney, NBC Universal, which has distribution with Comcast, even Netflix. I mean, are they actually strong enough even together to take on this landscape?
I think that this will not be the last transaction that we see with these companies. There's been talk for several years that this is but a first step. And exactly as you say, they probably are going to need even more scale going forward. There are still some dance partners out there, not a lot, but there are some. So I think, you know, people should be keeping an eye on that going forward.
I wonder, though, the big players in this space own both the content and the distribution. Do you think that even, you know, we're starting to see even some cracks in Netflix armor? Is content alone even enough?
That is a question that all media company CEOs are asking themselves at this moment. What's been fascinating is how much regulators seem open to the tie-up of content and distribution. I mean, yes, the Justice Department did try to sue to block AT&T's purchase of Time Warner, but they ultimately lost, and that's gone forward. So that does seem to be where the market's going.
This is a little bit far afield, but I wonder, did CBS hamper itself for all those years by not building a more robust digital ecosystem? Did they leave themselves too dependent on cable?
Well, actually, CBS has done a pretty interesting job with its direct-to-consumer offering, CBS All Access. They definitely zigged when everyone else in the industry zagged. They were not part of Hulu, which is kind of what everyone else did in the broadcast space. But they really surpassed my first expectations about how CBS All Access would fare. And so I think their direct-to-consumer strategy has been pretty smart. And I thought it was very interesting that in announcing the deal today, that was the number one priority across the new company.
So for people who watch the properties owned by these networks, are they going to see any change? Or if so, when might that happen?
Well, they have said that they would like their first priority to be accelerating this direct-to-consumer strategy. So what's happening in the broader industry is that a lot of folks are basically taking their ball and going home, right? They're taking their own content off these services like Netflix and making their own direct-to-consumer products like Disney has done. We've seen CBS do a little bit of that. We've seen Viacom play with it a little bit. So I would expect a much more robust offering in that way, and maybe you would see this content less often in other places.
Keech Hagee writes about television for the Wall Street Journal's Media and Marketing Bureau. Her book is called The King of Content: Sumner Redstone's Battle for Viacom, CBS, and Everlasting Control of His Media Empire. Keech, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, trade wars still on. Tariffs are coming back in a few months, but for today at least, Wall Street let the good times roll. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Fuel tanker drivers in Portugal are on strike today. They're asking for pay raises and better working conditions. That has meant that gas stations are running low, just as Portugal's tourism season is ramping up. Tourism was one of the ways Portugal managed to bounce back from an economic crisis 8 years ago, alongside a bailout from the European Union. Now, though, the country is trying to figure out how to keep that economic recovery going. For the BBC, Lisa Lewis reports from Portugal.
El Clandestino, a Mexican restaurant bar in Lisbon's Bairro Alto, is part of Portugal's economic success story. It's one of five bars João Batista has opened since 2011. Because when the economy started to hit rock bottom nearly a decade ago, tourists began arriving in ever-increasing numbers.
I got lucky. Suddenly, Lisbon became the trendy city of Europe, and I was able to ride that wave.
Nobody believed that the economy would stay contracting.
But the economic growth from tourism might not be sustainable, says Pedro Brinca, professor for macroeconomics at Lisbon's Nova Universidade.
Tourism is a highly volatile phenomena. Other countries can become the new fashion destination. And we benefited a lot from the Arab Spring. Arab Spring turmoil is bound to go away. As soon as Tunisia's tourism industry starts bouncing back, people start going back to Egypt and Turkey.
And the country has another problem, its rapidly aging population.
Even if we come up with policies that can allow the younger generations to have families, they will only take effect on the labor markets in the next 20 years. So to address the transitional problem, the only way I see is migration.
The government is working on plugging the labor market hole. It wants to attract more foreign workers, take in more refugees, and bring back the hundreds of thousands of Portuguese who left during the crisis. It is fast-tracking high-tech and startup visas and offering financial support to homecoming Portuguese from this year on.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Lisa Luiz from the BBC.
Nice meeting you.
Pedro Cisa Vieira is Portugal's Minister of Economy.
It is crucial that we are capable of securing this inflow of people. Young people departed because the economy is not providing sufficiently attractive jobs. That landscape is changing. The country needs them. Their work is now valued, and refugees will be also welcome.
But not everybody feels Portugal is doing what's needed to offer a good economic future. In São João de Talha, a small suburb near Lisbon, dozens of refugees are queuing at a government immigration centre. The 28-year-old Abdurrahman Ibrahim from Eritrea arrived 6 years ago. But the hairdresser is still not allowed to work in his profession. I was told I needed to speak proper Portuguese, he tells me, but there are no good language courses to really learn it. And I need to do a course to validate my hairdresser qualification, which costs thousands of euros. And are the government initiatives enough to bring native Portuguese workers back home? In France, the biggest Portuguese diaspora in the world has grown further since the crisis. Project manager Richard Tavares arrived from Aveiro in northern Portugal a few years ago. He could benefit from the new government measures for homecomers, but he says moving back is out of the question.
I don't think people will decide to go back because of this program. Wages are a lot higher abroad, and there are a lot more stable jobs here. If someone goes back, it's for personal reasons.
With rents and prices going up steadily in Portugal and wages stagnating, the saudade, nostalgic longing for home, might still be Portugal's best way to convince its people to return.
That was Lisa Lewis reporting from Portugal. President Trump visited natural gas drilling country today, Western Pennsylvania, to tout what he calls American energy dominance. And actually, that area is struggling under what you might call over-dominance. There is too much natural gas from drilling and fracking, so the selling price has plummeted. One source of hope is a new big buyer coming in, a multi-billion-dollar petrochemical plant that will turn some ingredients of natural gas into plastics. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The price of natural gas has hit a three-year low because there's too much, too many drillers in Pennsylvania, too much natural gas coming out of the ground with oil in Texas. So Pennsylvania energy firms now drill in places with not just gas, but other liquids to sell on the side. Propane, ethane, butane. Rusty Brazil is president of RBN Energy.
The more hydrocarbons that I sell out of the well, the better off I am. So I am better off selling propane, butanes, and natural gasoline rather than just selling a dry natural gas.
Ethane gets sold to petrochemical plants, like the one the president visited in Pennsylvania today. And they turn ethane into the main ingredient in plastics, which, says Joseph Markman at Hart Energy, will ship to Europe to make retail plastic stuff.
The plastic products come back to us on store shelves in terms of water bottles, in terms of containers for peanut butter and mayonnaise.
So natural gas from fracking has fueled America's chemical and plastics businesses. But they, too, could make more than the world wants. With plastic particles increasingly found in the oceans and the air, there's a backlash against overuse. Economist Christoph Ruhl is with Cristal Energy.
Everybody sees that he doesn't need to have plastic bags necessarily. You can do your shopping in a different way. So this is a campaign, an environmental campaign. I don't know how justified it is, but it has all the ingredients of success.
For now, though, the hope in Pennsylvania is that a petrochemical plant can bring a lifeline to the struggling natural gas industry. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up,
check out my nondescript khakis and supercuts hairstyle. I'm here to amaze you.
Life lessons from an IT guy. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, let's party. Stocks moved higher after the U.S. said it is delaying some China tariffs until December, including mobile phones, and taking some items off the tariff list altogether. The holidays are saved. The Dow Jones Industrial Average surged 372 points, 1.4%, to close at 26,279. The NASDAQ perked up 152 points, 1.9%, to finish at 8016. And the S&P 500 added 42 points, 1.4%, to end at 2926. Not all good news for Apple, which will benefit from some of those delayed tariffs, but apparently AirPods and the Apple Watch will not be getting that reprieve. Nevertheless, Apple up 4.2% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.70%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Speaking of major media mergers and consolidation, here's a tale of how that can sometimes turn out. Back in 2013, there was Yahoo. Remember that? And that year, Yahoo bought the social blogging platform Tumblr for $1 billion. And then Verizon bought Yahoo a few years later, merged it with AOL, and poor Tumblr got a little lost in the shuffle. This week, Verizon announced it was offloading Tumblr for a, quote, nominal sum, as in way less than $1 billion. Tumblr could have been the first Instagram. So how did it go the way of MySpace? Marketplace's Jack Stewart takes a look.
In its prime, Tumblr generated passion amongst those who wrote, read, and shared short blogs and internet memes.
Tumbling down Tumblr, there's so many cats. Look, this one's wearing a hat.
This YouTube tribute is called Tumblr the Musical. It was published in 2012 by Hank Green, one of the popular vlog brothers.
There was a moment in time when it was sort of small and beautiful, and it felt very collected and understandable.
Verizon acquired Tumblr through its purchase of Yahoo in 2017. Yahoo itself, of course, is another example of the cruel cycle of internet popularity. Keith Snyder's an analyst at CFRA.
One day you're really, really fast growing, top of the dog heap, and then the next day you're being sold kind of for pennies on the dollar.
Tumblr alienated a lot of users last year when it banned pornography and adult content. But it's always just had a hard time competing with Facebook and Twitter, and more recently the likes of Instagram and TikTok. And that's just the way of social media. It thrives and then withers, says Jessa Lingle at the University of Pennsylvania.
It's the cycle unless you're so big that you just buy out your competition. Facebook has proved fairly immune to this cycle, but that's mostly because it's willing to buy things like WhatsApp and Instagram.
Lingle says a social media site doesn't have to be as huge as Facebook to be successful. Tumblr could just continue to serve more niche audiences. YouTuber Hank Green agrees that's the way to go.
Yeah, definitely don't be everything to everyone. That's taken.
Yeah, by Facebook and Twitter.
Tumblr's the place,
for me.
I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
This country is in the middle of an affordable housing crisis, especially on the coasts. And as a result, home sales in big coastal cities are down 4% compared to last year, according to the National Association of Realtors. But if you look at cities further inland, you might see a slightly different story. A housing market boom in the heart of the Midwest. Laura Cusisto wrote about that boom for the Wall Street Journal. Laura, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
All right. So you wrote that Midwest cities are now starting to see a housing boom. What cities are we talking about here?
Kind of a real good variety of cities, everywhere from Kansas City to Cleveland to, this isn't the Midwest, but Boise, kind of a lot of these kind of secondary cities are seeing a real boom right now in their housing markets.
And is the common denominator, is there a common denominator, or is it just that, you know, they were cheaper than the other big cities?
Well, that's a pretty good common denominator, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a lot of these places were less expensive, and they were slower to recover from the housing bust. They didn't have that same kind of boom in technology jobs that helped drive the recovery in a lot of places on the West Coast and on the East Coast. And so now they're kind of playing catch up.
So what is that mean? I mean, you write that now there are bidding wars in these cities and that then housing prices are going to start outstripping wages there. Does that mean that there is like nowhere in America that anyone can afford a house anymore?
This is a little bit of a catch-22 that when people in California start selling their homes for $1 million and moving to Cleveland or Boise, it just naturally makes those places more expensive. So I think if you're moving from a high-wage place and you can keep your high-wage job and you can sell your home still for a bunch of money and take that cash, it still looks affordable to you, but it probably doesn't look affordable to someone who's been growing up in Grand Rapids and suddenly home prices are growing by double digits.
Well, then does it mean that there is going to be a change in Oakland or New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles? Or is it just going to be, you know, sort of crazy everywhere?
We are for sure already seeing a change in those places. It's just a matter of putting in context what that change looks like. Home prices in the sort of San Jose area, home prices in Seattle and LA, they are declining. But that's different from saying that those places are going to be super affordable. We're talking about, you know, a place that was maybe selling for $1.3 million, selling for $1.2 million. So it's not going to totally remake these places, but it's a big shift in those markets and a kind of worrying one.
Let's talk about the good news, though. I would imagine that if you live in Grand Rapids or Boise or Kansas City, that and you're a real estate agent or somebody who has been waiting for, you know, the boom to catch up to you, that this is some good news.
Oh, and for sure, we should say if you're pretty much anybody who owns their home already, right? I mean, we talked to people who saw, you know, their home sell in a day. It's really just if you're a renter who's still looking to buy, that this probably isn't great news for you.
And then just in terms of the economic factors, how big an influence are low rates right now? Are they driving sort of what might be like a short-term boom, like you're saying?
Oh, my God. This is a question I'm really trying to answer. I would think that rates should be driving a boom everywhere. Rates are at their near lowest level in nearly 3 years. But when I talk to real estate agents, that actually doesn't seem to be the driving factor for people right now. Affordability is such a big issue for people that getting a slightly lower mortgage rate, it doesn't seem to be kind of juicing these markets as much. I think it's helping a little bit in the kind of lower price ranges and in some of these more affordable markets. But right now, the big story really is home prices and affordability.
What do you think that this means broadly? Do you think there's ever going to be an equalization, or are we just going to see the, you know, this sort of hot housing market shift and continue to spread like a virus?
Yeah, I think what this kind of tells us is that we're entering, I think, a bit of a new phase in the housing cycle. Until now, it's been driven by big cities with these really good high-wage jobs. And I think we're going to see a shift away from those cities towards some of these cheaper locations. There's sort of an open question in my mind how long a city like Kansas City or Grand Rapids could sustain double-digit price increases. I just don't think that you have the same kind of wage growth, the same kind of really high-paying jobs there. In general, the housing market is slowing down. And I think these cities are going to buck that trend for a while, but probably not forever.
Laura Cazzisto covers housing for the Wall Street Journal. Laura, thanks so much for the time.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Unfounded and unfair sometimes, there are still stereotypes about the office IT guy. They might be related to style, social skills, overall nerdiness. Plenty of people buck those stereotypes, of course. Some fight them completely, but some just lean right on in, as evidenced by the next installment in our occasional series highlighting creative out-of-office emails called Automatic Reply.
Sorry, friend. I'm almost entirely unavailable for your needs, important as they may be. There's only so much joy you can experience surrounded by other IT professionals. Sometimes you have to open yourself up to the world and say, hey, check out my nondescript khakis and supercuts hairstyle. I'm here to amaze you. You guessed it. I'm traveling. Wi-Fi permitting, I will be responding to email whilst I'm away,
But don't assume yours will be at the top of my list. To hit the number one spot in my inbox, you'll need to be A, brief, B, funny, C, not spam, D, not Jason, E, not written in Comic Sans. If you desperately need more attention during my sojourn, then reach out to the good people of tech support. They can listen to your plight and play soothing whale music to ease your distress until my return.
Man, poor Jason. Jim Rispin is the director of information technology at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California. Tell us about your out-of-office message, regardless of what font it's written in, at marketplace.org. This final note before we go is a little bit of a postscript to the CBS and Viacom story and the media merger landscape. Fast Company reports today that cable TV providers just took their biggest hit yet from cord cutting. Cable is now losing as many subscribers as satellite TV. But the article points out that the biggest cable companies may not need cable anymore. They can license their content to streaming services like Hulu or Netflix and then charge you for the internet access you need to stream. See how that works? Vertical integration, children. All right, this party is over. The Dow is up today 372 points, 1.4%. The NASDAQ up 152 points, that's 1.9%. And the S&P 500 up 42 points, 1.4%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Muti is the Executive Director of Digital. Sitar Nieves is our Executive Director of On-Demand. And I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. We'll be back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.